So we're going to talk a little bit more about leadership. We've been talking about leadership, and we want to kind of close our mini little series of lessons here tonight. Whenever we're talking about leadership, whether it's in the marriage or the family or the church or society, we can do a great disservice to that by talking about what might be called romantic idealism, something that belongs in the realm of fiction and fairy tales rather than in real life. For example, if you remember King Arthur and the knights and the stories of the Round Table there, there was a time of chivalry and the valiant warriors, and they were duty-bound to a fault, and all this is very romantic. And by romantic, I don't mean people falling in love. That's not romantic in this context, but simply fanciful or fictitious and imaginative, but not very practical. And it only works in a setting where everyone cooperates, where the storyline is followed, and you know nobody deviates from that. And we see a lot of that in our modern video games and our modern movies. They have distorted our sense of reality. If you're playing a video game, fallen leaders get a new life force when they die. Just like in real life, right? Not quite. And then they re-enter the game and carry on. That's not really what happens. Real life is not characterized by Hollywood drama and eye-popping special effects at every turn. That's just not real life. We need to be careful of that. When we're teaching leadership, when we're teaching these things, we cannot teach ideals, goals, or high standards without also being realistic. We want to be realistic. We want to say, okay, there is a standard that God sets for us, but realistically, we're not saying, but we're never going to hit it. That's not what we're saying, but rather being realistic in how we go about that, okay? So the Bible presents Christ as the ideal, and it's not that we become Christ, but it does mean that the Bible is there, or Christ is there as our example, so that we can strive to be like Him. And that nobody ever reaches the perfection of Christ, but we get closer and closer into conformity with Him. And so nobody ever arrives and then can say, look down from their lofty tower or their pedestal and say, well, now you little people, come up to me. You know, I mean, we're all striving to attain to that goal there that Paul talks about and that we'll actually cite here in later on in this lesson. So we want to apply all this to leaders and leadership because we don't live in a sterile, pristine vacuum in which everything works exactly like we set it out to be or set out to have it work, and we ought not to pretend otherwise. So, as I said in my introduction this morning, it might help us to realize that some of the greatest Bible leaders had character flaws and personal challenges. And they wrestled with their own faith and their devotion. And sometimes they had a number of failures. And in some areas, they did very well. They led very well. And in other areas, they led very poorly. So we want to learn then that leadership doesn't happen overnight. And it doesn't happen without problems or setbacks. We also want to recognize that it takes time to develop skills to lead. And it also takes time to apply or implement those skills rightly. That's being realistic. You can learn defensive driving, for example, from a defensive driving instructor in the classroom with a PowerPoint slideshow. Okay? But you're never really going to learn defensive driving until you get in the car and you start practicing what you learned in the classroom. That's really what we're dealing with right now. We're talking about classroom stuff right now, but your intention is to carry out into your life, in the real world, what we learn here as concepts and ideals. So hopefully we're seeing our biblical leaders in a full perspective with their failures as well as their successes. And that makes them more real to us, but it also makes them more like us, if you will, or makes us more like them, however you want to look at that. All right, so we're going to start with Moses. And there was none better suited to take Israel out of Egypt than Moses. He was a prince to Pharaoh. He was raised with Egyptian education, as well as very knowledgeable of Hebrew culture. He was the perfect liaison between the Pharaoh, and the Hebrews. He was intelligent. He was organized. He was literate. He was uncompromising. He was perfectly fitted for the job, and God knew that. The problem is that Moses didn't know that, or at least didn't see himself that way, and he was disillusioned very early on and rejected as a deliverer. I'm not going to take time because this is something you can do on your own, but if you read Stephen's account of Moses in Acts chapter 7, verse 23 through 28, it kind of gives you the synopsis that we're looking for here, where Moses thought he was appointed by God to deliver Israel, basically on Moses' own terms. And so he sees an Israelite and an Egyptian arguing, and Moses goes over there and kills the Egyptian and think that that's all part of the plan until later on two Hebrews are arguing and Moses tries to, you know, get them to calm down, and one of them turns on him and says, "What, are you going to kill me like you killed that Egyptian?" And at that remark, Moses realizes that he's not, in the eyes of his people anyway, the deliverer that he thought he was. And he leaves for the land of Midian and disappears for 40 years. And that's when God calls him and says, in essence, "Certainly I will be with you." And what he says, in essence, too, is, "You can't deliver these people without me, but with me you can do the impossible." So we're kind of going through this very briefly, of course, and just taking a snapshot view, but we want to kind of have a bird's eye view of this first conversation that Moses has with God, and also Moses' response. So God's telling him, "I need you to go to Pharaoh and do this thing." And Moses' first response is, "Of course I'll do that. I'm the perfect liaison between the Egyptians and the Hebrews. I'm educated, organized, and..." No, that's not what he says. He says, "Who am I to do this?" And that's a good question, but God says, "Well, I will be with you. I will be your power." "Oh, well, that's good. Well, then I don't know your name." And so God says his personal memorial name, which is the noun form of the verb in Hebrew, "I am," or known to us as Yahweh, or anglicized, Jehovah. And so then Moses says, "Well, what if they don't listen to me?" And so God says, "Well, there's three signs. You can throw down your staff and it becomes a serpent, and then a staff again. You can put your hand in your bosom and take it out, it'll be leprous. Put it in again and pull it out, and it'll be perfectly healthy. And you can turn water into blood." Three signs that are irrefutable, convincing proof. And Moses says, "Oh, that's good. That'll be exactly what I need." That's not what he says. What he says then is, "Well, I'm not eloquent." And so God says, "Well, I made your mouth. I'll give you speech." And after all this stalling and all these excuses, finally in Exodus 4:13, Moses says, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever you will." I want you to think about what's happening here. God has come to Moses and given him every reason to succeed. Told him exactly what he needs to do, says that, "I'll be with you, I'll be your strength, I'll be your power, I'm going to be the one to make this happen." And Moses says, "That's a great plan for someone else. Let me know who you pick for that." And in Exodus 4:14, it says, "The anger of the Lord burned against Moses." I know we often paint Moses in a larger-than-life picture where he can do no wrong. He's the archetypal father of all mankind, faithful and everything else. I mean, in the Jews' mind, there is no one greater in the world than Moses, etc. But here he is in this first encounter with God, and it says the anger of the Lord burned against him, and rightly so. Imagine, after all he's seen and heard, and God is simply not being believed by Moses. Now, I think, in fairness, Moses did not doubt God's deliverance or God's power, but I do think he doubted his own participation or his own effectiveness in that deliverance. And I think that's what he's wrestling with here. He doubted his own ability to act because he's acting on his own ability. He's seeing only his part and what he has done. Remember what has happened in the past. He's very conscious of his own doubts, his own faults, his own failed attempts to lead the people in the first place. And he doesn't want to go through that again. Doesn't want to be rejected again. So finally, God gives Aaron, his brother, as a mouthpiece, but Aaron turns out to be more of a distraction than a help. He is eloquent, but he is no Moses. And Aaron's characteristics and sometimes decisions there are questionable, but Moses stands the test of time. In fact, I think we can safely say, and this will be a whole other lesson to get into this one point, but for the sake of our lesson, Moses really became the leader that God wanted him to be when he finally learned to trust in God. And that was the message that he finally gave to Israel as well. When he became Israel's lawgiver, one thing he said over and over in so many words is, you need to trust the Lord. You need to love the Lord with all your heart, soul, and might. You need to trust in God. You need to love God. Love him. Trust him. Love him. Trust him. Over and over and over that God, or Moses rather, pounded that into the Israelites' mind. And rightly so, because that is the source of success. And if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 34, at the very end of Deuteronomy there's a little eulogy, if you will, for Moses. And starting in verse 10 of Deuteronomy chapter 34, it says, since that time, this is after Moses dies, since that time no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. For all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to perform in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh, all his servants and all his land, and for all the mighty power and for all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all of Israel. That's a pretty big tribute. And that tribute stands the test of time. God knew Moses face to face. That doesn't mean that Moses was brought into the actual presence of God, but that God knew him intimately, not distantly or remotely. All right, so we've looked at our snapshot view of Moses, and you might ask yourself, well, what lessons are there for us? I'm no Moses, someone might say, but you don't have to be a Moses. You can learn from Moses, and if you're unwilling to learn from Moses, well, then you shouldn't be a leader, or you're not trying to be a leader. Here's some things to draw or extract from what we've talked about so far. Sometimes we try to be a deliverer or a leader, and we get disillusioned by that because things don't work out as we thought. We expected everyone to cooperate with our plans. We expected everyone to fulfill our own expectations of how things should come down, right? And how things should go, including God himself. I mean, we expected the fact that we had plans and they seemed, you know, good plans. We expect God himself to cooperate with us. And when they don't, when those people, including God, don't cooperate with our plans, we get frustrated and disillusioned. And then what do? Well, we walk away, disillusioned, carrying a grudge perhaps, or maybe just running, or just lost in the sense of we really don't know where we're supposed to be. Remember what happened to Moses, okay? And that 40-year period of time in the land of Midian was not very productive in a way, if you think about it. I mean, there's a certain amount of perhaps preparation in the form of maturity and you know whatever else you gain from older age, but Moses really wasn't doing anything at that time. You have to ask yourself, what are you doing if indeed that talks about you, what you've done and what you've experienced? Or we may have faith in God's power, but we may have little confidence in ourselves because we separate ourselves from God's power. There's something that needs to be done, and we're like, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. But then we are very mindful of our faults. We're very conscious of our lack of ability. We're very conscious of how we might have failed at this in the past. And that all comes back to us, and that is daunting, and that imposes upon us, and then we lose confidence. And the problem there is not that we had faults or failures or things like that in the past. That's really not the issue. The issue is that we're putting all our chips in our own selves. We're depending upon ourselves far more than we're depending upon God. And when people do that, then they see themselves as, well, I'm too old to do that, or I'm too young to do that, or I'm too weak to do that, or I'm too timid, or I'm too unskilled in speech, I'm too lacking in knowledge. Here's an actual application of that. We've been talking, a bunch of us have been getting together every couple of weeks and talking about the fundamentals of faith. And what is the purpose of that class? The purpose of that class is for you to have the confidence to sit down with someone and teach them the gospel. Now, whose power is it that's going to do that? If you're going to rely only on your own eloquence and your own knowledge and your own factual information and your own ability, probably you're not going to do this at all because you're well aware of your limitations. And that will come out, actually. You're going to project that. But if you pray to God and ask him to help and let him be the source of your strength and let him be the one who brings you together with whoever it is that needs to hear this gospel, that you can influence and that you can help, and let him be your strength. Remember, Moses' success was when he learned to depend upon God's power rather than Moses' own. That's something that you and I need to learn as well, depending on his power. Our confidence in God instills confidence in others. But our lack of confidence in God also instills lack of confidence in others. Courage is contagious. Lack of confidence also is contagious. So, which one are you going to show? Which one do we need to see from you? Think about it from that perspective. The point here is that we are never going to learn to lead, or as we ought to lead, until we learn to, first of all, put our full trust in God. Now, I'm asking you, are you putting your trust in God? After all that we have seen, all that we've heard, all that we've read in Scripture, all that we believe, can we honestly say, hey, God, you've got a great plan and a great gospel. Send whoever you will to teach it. Will not his anger burn against you? And rightly so. All right, well, moving on. Let's move on to David now. David, early on in his life, after he had become king of Israel, that is, had much going for him. He was a valiant warrior. He seemed like an ideal leader. Some of the reading in 2 Samuel there, particularly in chapter 7 that we had read for us there to save us a little time in our lesson there. I mean, there's some great highlights of who David is and what has happened and where he's at that time. In the next couple chapters, 2 Samuel chapter 8, 2 Samuel chapter 10, we see the conquest of the surrounding nations. David is powerful, he is respected, everything is going so well. And then there is Bathsheba. 2 Samuel chapter 11. And you have to ask yourself, like I've asked myself, like all of us have asked ourselves at some point here in this study, how can someone be so great in some things and yet find it so difficult to manage their own personal desires? How can that happen? Well, maybe because we've all done the same thing. Maybe that's how it happens. Maybe this is just human nature rising or bubbling to the surface here. But for nearly a year, David keeps his sin secret and leads a double life. And not only that, but he involves other people in his sin as accomplices as well. And then we have Nathan coming to David. Remember the same Nathan who said in 2 Samuel 7, which Phil had read for us, how great David was going to be. The same prophet Nathan now comes and says, hey, I want you to hear about something. There's these two men in the city. One's rich and one's poor. And the poor man just has this little ewe lamb. And that's all he has for his possession. And it's very dear to him. And the rich man has all kinds of things. And the rich man has a guest coming into town. And instead of taking a lamb from his own flock, he takes this man's lamb and slaughters it for his friend. And imagine this. David not getting so upset over his own scenario, but now there's this story of this lamb and all this moral indignation. Why, that man ought to pay fourfold for that injustice. And Nathan says, you are the man. And what happens to David? Well, he pays fourfold. Because almost immediately we begin seeing the effects of what happens there. He loses four sons. In the first child that he and Bathsheba have together in their illicit relationship there, that child dies by the hand of God. His other son, Amnon, commits incest with his sister Tamar and is thus killed by his brother Absalom. Absalom usurps the throne, violates the concubines of David, begins a civil war. He himself is hunted down and he is killed. His other son, Adonijah, tries to usurp the throne from Solomon, and Solomon orders him to be executed. Fourfold, just like David predicted, should happen. You see, the thing here is that problems in the family directed David's ability to lead. These problems undermined his credibility and his objectivity. His emotional attachments, and this is important here for any of us, his emotional attachments to women and or his sons, or we could say his family in general, clouded his judgment as to determining what is in the best interest of Israel. I want to read you something. It's not in your notes, but in 2 Samuel 19, it will be in your notes from this point forward. But for now, 2 Samuel chapter 19, verse 5 and 6, this is where Absalom has died, and Joab, David's military commander, comes to him after David's going through the city crying out, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Remember all the turmoil and everything that Absalom had done. And Joab comes to him and says in verse 5, "Today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased." That's a pretty stinging rebuke, but it was entirely appropriate. And it's exactly what David needed to hear at that time. Sin had compromised David's leadership. You cannot walk with God and also at the same time walk in sin. Such a basic fundamental concept, and yet how many people try time after time to go against this very basic rule? Sin and godliness are an incompatible marriage. Can't work. It will not work. It's not that it will work for you if you try really hard, but it hasn't worked for millions of others. No, it will not work, period. And David may have learned the lesson quickly, but it took a long time for him to overcome the consequences. And God's message to David was, in essence, well, forgiveness is free. Because actually, if in second, back into 2 Samuel 12, Nathan said, "God has forgiven your sin." However, the consequences of your actions are going to follow you for the rest of your life because you chose to learn leadership the hard way. But by the time of his death, David became a man after God's own heart. And he says these words to Solomon on his own deathbed. He says, "Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn." 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 2 and 3. That's pretty impressive. David having gone through all that and then coming to that point or that conclusion in his life. Someone says, "Well, I'm no David," but you don't have to be David. You can learn from him. Imitate his strengths, but avoid his pitfalls. Here's one of the lessons you should learn. Don't be passive about sin. You may excel in many areas, but moral purity cannot be compromised. So do not think that you are above the law, whoever you are. And do not think that you are not accountable for your actions, whatever they are. And do not think that you can take licenses that you would not allow others to take or that God would not allow others to take. You can't take them either. These are some of the lessons that should come ringing out of our study, brief as it was, of David. Here's another point that you could derive from that, and that is that self-serving agendas, however hidden or however we think they are hidden, are always going to compromise and corrupt what is good intentions. In other words, you may have a great plan to serve God, and that's noble and that's honorable, but if you have other agendas going on underneath the surface, so to speak, that's going to compromise your plan to serve God. Being a man after God's own heart, this is so important to say. Being a man after God's own heart is too important to be jeopardized by other people or family members or your own emotions. It's too important. I'm not saying abandon your family or get rid of your family members. I'm simply saying you can't put people or even your own emotions ahead of God or your duty to God. That will always end in disaster if you do that. And a third thing we could say is, do not think that your sin only affects you. It affects people around you as well. David's sin was between David and Bathsheba. But in the position that he was in as a leader of that nation, the nation of Israel, it affected the entire nation. The civil war and all the people that were killed in that war were a result of David's actions. Think about cancer, for example. When it gets in your body, it doesn't just sit there in one place. One of the attributes of cancer is that it grows. it spreads to other parts of your body. And sin is much the same way. When we choose to not be holy or spiritual, we hurt more than ourselves. We hurt our wife or our husband. We hurt our children. We hurt our friends. And we hurt our own congregation. We become a liability. However, when we choose to be spiritual and holy, we help our wife or husband or children and congregation. We become an asset. So you might ask yourself, which one are you to us? Are you an asset or are you a liability? You're the one that makes that decision. And finally, we want to look at the Apostle Paul, because no one other than Jesus Christ himself has made a greater impact or had a greater contribution to Christianity than the Apostle Paul. He was a man of powerful ambition, courage, intelligence, wisdom, rabbinical scholarship. He had a tireless zeal for what he believed to be right. I mean, he is the kind of person that you want in your camp. He's the kind of person that you want on your Rolodex, you know, to call whenever you have a question or whenever there's something to get done. He's the man to do it. But having said all those great things about him, he's also like a stubborn mule, and he had to be goaded in an opposite direction than what he thought he should go. And he kicked against those goads, right? He kicked against those ox goads there, and it was only to his own harm that he did so. And this is all brought out in Acts chapter 9 in the account of his conversion on the road to Damascus there. And so while he was thinking that he was going to Damascus in order to fulfill God's will and stamp out this movement, this heresy, this blasphemous enactment of others called the way, and it was his resolve to vanquish that and to ruin those people, Christ gave him 3 days to think of it from an entirely different point of view while he sat in the blindness of his own personal darkness there. And he was blinded from seeing his own desire and his own direction and his own prejudice for the first time in his life, and was now able to see the light. There is that great paradox. In the blindness, in the darkness, he was finally able to see the light. And so God said no to several things. He said no to Paul being a great and learned rabbi. Instead, he would become a servant to the Gentiles of all people. You have to understand that to the Jews, Gentiles were like dogs. I mean, that's how they regarded them. And yet Paul was going to be a servant to those people. And he was also, God said no to defending the law of Moses against the gospel. Instead, Paul would become a proclaimer of a better law and a better person than Moses, and that would be Christ and his gospel. And he also said no to Paul's persecuting Christians, and he would learn what it meant to be persecuted by his own people. Everything turned around. The whole thing turned upside down in every which way. And it didn't end there either. Paul's fierce determination, his fierce ambition continued to be redirected by the Spirit. We read in Acts chapter 16, for example, where he sought to go into Asia Minor, but he was told instead to go into Phrygia and Galatia. He sought to go into Bithynia up to the north, but instead he was told to go westward into Macedonia. In Romans 15:28, he's telling the Romans in his letter, he says, my intention is to come to Rome and spend some time with you. And God said, that's fine, but it's not going to be in the terms that you thought. It's going to be in chains rather than as a free man. In 2 Corinthians 12, he has this thorn in the flesh, and he entreats God 3 times to have it removed, and God says no. He says that my power is perfected in your weakness, and my grace is sufficient for you, Paul. So God said no. No, no. I want you to think about this, parents. Sometimes I hear young mothers especially saying, I feel like I'm telling my child no all the time. What do you think God says to us? Doesn't he say no to us a lot? And isn't it in our best interest to hear that? Listen, if you're saying no to your child just to be an evil tyrant parent, well, that's one thing. But if you're telling the child no because it's in that child's best interest, then you're doing exactly what God does for us and what God did for Paul here as well. And you might think through all this that Paul's going to get discouraged and despondent and throw in the towel, right? No. He learned through his experiences. In Galatians chapter 2, verse 20, he says that profound statement, it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. In other words, what he's saying is what you already know. Christ's will is far more important than my own. Imagine that. This is the same man who sat there kicking against the goads, would not listen. Wow, I got to get those Christians, you know, stamp this movement out. And then now here he is saying, I learned a lesson, Lord. It's your will that is most important. And in Philippians chapter 3, verse 14 and 15, he says, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Let us therefore, as many as are perfect or mature, have this attitude. And if in anything you have a different attitude, God will reveal that to you also. Well, God had revealed a different attitude in Paul several times, hasn't he? And what was Paul's response to that? Paul accepted the lesson and accommodated God, if you will, accommodated God's teaching and made it his own. You say, well, where is all that going? So he died a bitter, frustrated man that was constantly fighting again? No, 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7 and 8. Paul's final words to Timothy, I've fought the good fight. I've finished the course. I've kept the faith. In the future, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. In the end, it was worth it all. Paul reached his goal, and he inspires the rest of us to follow him. What are some lessons you can draw from this? Someone might say, well, I'm no Paul. You don't have to be Paul, but you can learn from him. Imitate him as he imitates Christ. Here's one lesson. Do not think that just because you have are zealous, or ambitious for some certain direction in your life, just because you have that zeal means that that's the direction you ought to be going. You know, and I'm going to do a whole lesson on this point here at some future time. So suffice it to say, sometimes we have people who are going against the grain. And everyone, and I'm talking about good advice from people, they're telling them, don't go there, don't go that way, don't go that direction. And they're going, well, I feel like this is God's will. I feel like I should go here. This is what I should do, and so on. And everyone else and circumstances themselves are saying, no, this is not the right way. But they go there anyway. Aren't they just like Paul was on the road to Damascus, kicking against the goads? And who always gets hurt in that process? The one who's kicking. So just because you're zealous and ambitious that you think certain things should happen a certain way, go a certain direction, doesn't mean that you're right. Secondly, don't lose heart and don't lose faith just because God says no to you. Realize that everything he does and everything he says, including the word no, is in your best interest. A reason exists, a good reason exists for him to say that to you, and he doesn't even have to tell you what that reason is. You've got to believe him. That's what makes him God and you the servant. And Paul realized that. The question is, have you realized that? And then finally, those with less than perfect attitudes have a choice. We can continue to live in defiance, or we can accept and internalize God's will as our own. You don't have to be a perfect leader. There's really, in our circle anyway, outside of Christ himself, there is no such thing. It is romantic. It is unrealistic. But you have to have great faith. One that doesn't doubt God. That doesn't doubt what he says and what he tells you to do. When 80-year-old Moses faced Pharaoh, he had no army. All he had at his side was an 83-year-old Aaron and his staff. And yet he had faith that God would deliver the entire people of Israel from Egypt. And he was right, because God's power is far greater than Moses' or Aaron's. When David suited up to fight Goliath, he found Saul's armor to be useless to him. But he overcame through faith in God. And he continued in that faith through the rest of his life. I'm not saying he didn't make mistakes. We saw some. But I'm saying that he never left his God. And he continued all the way until his death, to have faith in God. When Paul carried the gospel into foreign fields, the only armor that he wore was the armor of God and the shield of faith. Think about that. Look at all that Paul accomplished. He didn't have some great army. He didn't have some great missionary society, you know, like some people think that is necessary. He didn't have some a whole bunch of thousands of Christians behind him supporting him and all kinds of this and that and the other thing. He just went in faith, and he knew that God was with him because he was following God's will rather than Paul's own. Leaders are not necessarily born, they are made. And sometimes it takes much time and experience to mold them, but it's no accident either that they become leaders, that is. The key here is to trust in the Father, that His way is best, that He will lead you in that way, and that He will make you useful to His cause. Remember what God told Moses right up front, "Certainly I will be with you." And remember Jesus' final words to us in the Gospel of Matthew, is that "I will be with you always, even to the end of the age." Whether that end of the age was the end of the disciples' own age who heard that, or the end of your age, Christ says, "I'll be with you." The question is not, will Christ really be there? That's not the question. He's proved himself capable. The real question is, do you believe in that? And do you believe in that so much that you're willing to follow him wherever he tells you to go, whatever he tells you to do? That's our short series on leadership. For what it's worth, I hope that it has helped you. I hope that you've gleaned something from this. For now, we leave the lesson to you to do with it whatever you will. I hope that this will inspire you. We're not here just to educate. We want to inspire you as well. And I hope that this has inspired you to do better, to do more, to trust in God even more than you have. If you need to come forward tonight, this will be the time to do so. Do come forward if you need, as we stand and sing the song that Bob has selected for us.